But yes, the topic indeed is slavery, Parshas Mishpatim, worth having a conversation about. The Torah's view of slavery, well, you have two different kinds of slavery, and that's what we're going to come back to ultimately with all of this, is understanding that better. But there is what's called the Eved Ivri, and then there's what's called the Eved Kanani. The Eved Ivri is a Jew who is an Eved to another Jew. And then there's the Eved Kanani, which is ostensibly a Canaanite, right? Someone from the land of Canaan who is an Eved to a Jew. Although Eved Kanani rules will apply to people who are not Jewish from elsewhere. It's called Eved Kanani. It's presented originally regarding the people you're going to meet when you come into the land of Canaan. And we're even going to see a view that associates being an Eved Kanani with being descendant from Canaan. We'll talk about that. But the Torah's vision for these two kinds of avdus, these two kinds of slavery, is actually very different. But the fundamental point, which I think you have to start the conversation with, both because it's going to help us understand our parsha and because it's worth knowing in general, is that being an Eved, as far as the Torah is concerned, is not the same thing as being a slave in North America in, you know, the, call it, you know, 1500s until the 1800s. It was a very different version of things, including quite a few laws that protect all avadim, Jewish and non-Jewish, and another layer of protection for Jews who are avadim, and then one rule that seems to protect specifically the non-Jewish Eved and not the Jewish Eved, and that's where I want to focus the conversation. So we're going to start out by talking about what these protections are for the Avadim, and then move into this weird rule that seems to protect the non-Jewish Eved but not the Jewish one, and talk about why that's so, and that will give us some insight into the way that slavery is envisioned within the Torah as a whole. I'm going to generally opt for the word Eved instead of the word slave, for two reasons. Number one, slave has a lot of connotations, like this North American version, that you'll see don't apply to the way the Torah is envisioning it. That's number one. But number two, because the word slave is an uncomfortable word. It's just, you know, it has certain meanings that, you know, I like to point out to people. If you look in the Sansino, the Art Scroll, standard translations of the Torah, when it talks about Jews being avadim in Egypt, it translates Eved as slave. When it talks about Jews being avadim to Hashem, it translates it as servant. Same word, but again, there's baggage associated with it, and we become less comfortable using the term slave. So I'd like to just steer clear and talk Eved instead of that, so everyone understands when I use the word Eved, that's what I'm talking about.
Servant is a better word for Eved Hashem, because you're serving your God.
Yes, but why doesn't the word slave fit? What is it about the word slave that doesn't fit?
It's a negative connotation.
Right? Is it anything else besides the negative connotation? In other words, I would argue...
It's not a choice.
One is like being done to you, one is you're doing.
So, I would argue that the key element of slave that I think makes people uncomfortable is the element of coercion. The element of you don't have free will. That's something that really makes the whole concept of being a slave very hard for people. But that's very much a part of being an Eved Hashem.
No, you have choice.
You have choice in the same way that you have choice to do any number of things. However, you have a covenant, you're a member of it, and therefore you are required to do this. Meaning, I have all sorts of agreements that I'm required to live up to. Technically, I have free will. I could break them. But it is a requirement on me, much as being a slave and fulfilling one's agreements as a slave. You know, agreements are not agreements. Agreements made by others for you. You know, it is technically you have free will. You could run away. You could shoot the master, whatever it is. But fundamentally, slavery includes not having the right to break away from it. And that's, I think that is supposed to be built into being an Eved Hashem. That is supposed to be part of it, whether it's something we're comfortable with or not. But let's see where this goes. So the baseline laws that protect a non-Jewish Eved. The Gemara in Yevamos Memches has it, but I brought you the Shulchan Aruch formulation just because I think that it's a clean and easy read. So look at number one, please, from the Shulchan Aruch. Ha'eved ha'nilkach me'ha'obed kochavim. If somebody purchases an Eved from Obdei Kochavim for short, Akum means people who are not Jewish. It's talking about a non-Jewish Eved. So, Omrim lo, you say to him, Ritzon chashati kanes leklal abde Yisrael batia me'aksherim alo. You ask him, do you want to enter the ranks of Avadim of Israel? In other words, you're going to be an Eved to a Jew. Is that okay with you? Do you want to be among the kosher? And you'll see what kosher means momentarily. Or not. In other words, you ask. This is not coercion. This is voluntary. Imratza, if he wants, modin lo ikare hadas, umitzas mitzvas kalos v'chamuros v'onshan uscharan. You tell him the basics of Judaism. You tell him the easier mitzvos, some of them. You tell him some of the more severe mitzvos, as well as the punishment for violating them, as well as the reward for keeping them. And obviously, at this point, you're thinking, is this slavery, or is this conversion, right? And that's what the Shulchan Aruch says, Kimo Shemodi and Esager. Just like you would inform somebody who said they wanted to convert to Judaism. So you have to give him all that information. Umat bilin oso kiger. You actually take him to mikvah. Umodian oso kishubamayim. And while he's in the water, you inform him. Meaning you, again, inform him of what he's accepting upon himself. In other words, to become an Eved, and this is true for a shechah, for a female as well, involves a level of conversion. The conversion is not complete until they're freed. Right, so then there'll be bris, and that'll be afterwards, and you know, when you have a beis hamikdash, there'll be a karban. That's all afterwards. If they're freed at some point, then the conversion is indeed completed, and they become a full-blown Jew. While they are an Eved, they're not fully Jewish. But that's your first step, is the voluntary acceptance of Judaism, and it continues. Lakach Eved gadol me'ha'ove kochavim v'lo ratzah ha'eved limol. Let's say you acquire an Eved who is an adult, and he's not interested in this circumcision thing, and circumcision here is shorthand for he doesn't want to become Jewish. Thanks, but no thanks. So now what happens? Megalgel imo kol yud beis chodesh. So you have 12 months to have him live with you, function as an Eved, and see if he changes his mind. Yeser al kain, beyond that, asur lekaimo kishahu arel. You're not allowed to keep him without bris milah. Elachozer umo chrola obe kochavim. You have to sell him to someone who isn't Jewish. He's not. You can't keep him as an Eved beyond that point. That's the rule. Says the Rama, there is an exception to this. The Rama writes that there's a possibility for an exception to the rule, which is if you do this acquisition on the condition that he will not be converted. That's only where you acquired the Eved in order to convert him. But if you actually stipulated, I'm not converting him, I'm not literally not going to have a bris for him. And that's really the key. The Rama writing in Poland in the 16th century, this is what happened in our land, where you're not allowed to have somebody convert to Judaism. The Christian authorities would not look very pleasantly at that. So he says, it's as though you had actually said, no, I am entering this agreement on condition that he's not going to have a bris. So you can keep him that way as long as you want. And he says that's the common practice. That actually became a very big issue in North America in colonial times. Meaning that there were Jews who had avadim, and they didn't go through the whole conversion ritual, and they relied on this Rama. That was what they were relying on, the idea that you can stipulate in the beginning they're not converting to Judaism. They're not.
Jews in the colonial times cared enough about.
Not all of them, but yes, there was actually when I was a rabbi in Rhode Island, there was a fellow by the name of Jonathan Schorsch.
You were rabbi in Rhode Island? That's
yes.
So cool.
Thanks. Okay. Yes.
I love Rhode Island. I'm going there in summer now. It's amazing.
Okay. Thanks. Just for those on the recording, yes, it's true. Rhode Island's a great place to be. I really enjoyed it too. So there was this fellow by the name of Jonathan Schorsch who did his doctoral work at Brown on relationships between Jews and African Americans in the, I think it was 16th to 19th century, 16th to 18th century, no, 16th to 19th, I think. He turned it into a book later on, but I have his, the full doctoral paper he gave me. And it's a remarkable read about what went on in colonial times. There was one community, I'm blanking on which island, where they actually had a shul that was for the children of relationships between the master and the eved. Specifically for them, like that's where they would go.
Wow.
Which is bizarre on so many levels. On so many, yes, correct.
Yeah, because then they would be Jewish.
Well, that's the question. That's part of the question here is, are these kids Jewish or are they not Jewish? What is going on in this whole picture? It's very strange. There's a lot of stuff that happened then, and the majority of people were not observant in the way that you and I would recognize observance. That's for sure true. And would not have been consulting Shulchan Aruch. But it's kind of surprising and weird what went on. I mean, there's one part in there where he talks about a slave auction that was, you know, they have dates for the auctions, and it was set for Rosh Hashanah, and they moved it because it was Rosh Hashanah, so that Jews would be able to participate. They were part of the society, and they did exactly what everybody else did. We like to think that, you know, Jews are better than everybody. Not better than everybody, that's the wrong word. But that Jews will carry the, will live up to a higher standard.
Hold that against them.
I don't know if you could hold it against them or not. I mean, it's not consistent. What went on there, I believe, is not consistent with what the Torah is prescribing or what we're going to be talking about now.
We should have had more sensitivity. We were slaves ourselves. I don't know.
I pulled
against that.
Me too.
I mean, I'm not.
Hundreds of years of regular. That's what everyone did.
It was good form. You have
okay.
to keep that in mind.
So we're gonna see more about this here. But that's just, you should be aware that Jews, including some who cared about Shulchan Aruch, absolutely held slaves in that period. Mm-hmm. It's true. Finishing the line in the Shulchan Aruch. Imales avdovid bilo ba'al korcho l'shem avdus. In the event that somebody says, well, I want to keep this person as an eved, you tell me they have to accept Judaism, so fine, I'll do it against his will. I'll coerce him. If somebody does that, lo asa klum. That is entirely ineffective. You have achieved nothing. There's no such thing as coercing somebody. It's not acceptable within Jewish law. And then this side note in parentheses, miyum asamir tzono v'nak mitzvos shel eved yochol shachar achakach be'al korcho. He says, in the event that the eved actually willingly says, no, I want to convert and I want to, you know, be an eved, and then later on you want to free him for some reason, and he says, no, I like being an eved, I'm doing my mitzvos and all that, you're able to free him. You can't, he can't say, well, I insist on remaining as an eved.
So unless it's not allowed in the country for them to convert, can you keep that condition and just say, I'm not...
So what's not clear to me, I have to go back to the sources of the Ramah, is whether his stipulation is just not to do bris milah, or whether the stipulation is not to have him convert at all. That's unclear to me, because he starts out by saying that you stipulated shlola mulo, not to give him a bris. On the other hand, the next words, the emphasis really seems to be about the geros as a whole. It's unclear to me, and I'd have to go back to his sources in order to see. So, number one protection for the non-Jewish Eved is he can't be coerced into being an Eved. Obviously, the rules that apply to all human beings, kavod habrios, you have to treat people with basic dignity, applies to the Eved as well. Ibn Ezra talks about something very interesting, which is the question of, if a master kills the Eved, is there a death penalty for doing so? Ibn Ezra says, absolutely. If you look at source number 2 from our Parsha, the Torah says, "Chiyake ish es avdo o es amaso b'shevet umeis tachas yado nakom yinakim." If somebody were to strike his Eved, male or female, with a rod, and they were to die, nakom yinakim, he, the Eved, shall be avenged. in Yomo Yomayim Yamod, but if he lives a day or two, lo yukam, he shall not be avenged. Ki chaspahu, he was his property. That's what the pasuk says. That's what the text says. So says Rabbi Avraham ibn Ezra here. The Kutim Amru, he says the Kutim have said, but when he says Kutim, it's not clear to me who he's referring to, whether he means Karaites, non-Jews, Christians, I'm not sure who he's referring to here. But he's referring to somebody he disagrees with. They said, Nakom Yi Nakim, there's vengeance, it means some kind of great punishment. Whereas, Im Yamod Yom Echad, if the Eved lives a day, then less punishment. Vim Yomayim, and if he lives 2 days, lo yukam klal, there's no punishment at all. V'rayasam shalom atzinu b'misas based in milas nekama, and he says their basis for it is, number one, their basis, I skipped some of him here. He says the part of their basis is this whole day, 2 days thing, suggesting that there are stages to what's being done. And number two, the fact that when the Torah describes capital punishment, it uses the word misa, usually death. Nakomi nakem, there's punishment, doesn't seem to mean death. So Ibn Ezra says, though, this is a mistake. He says, it means indeed that there is a death penalty for a master who kills his eved. That's the way to read it. And he goes, you can see it here, using my translation, he says, the word nekama is used in the Torah to refer to killing, to refer to death. He gives you some examples. I brought you one of them, but he brings multiple. And he says the key line here is the last line. V'akasav sh'amar z'amisa b'milas nekama. The reason why the Torah frames death, the death penalty, as vengeance here is ki ha'adon misgolel ba'avdo ba'avur hayoso birshuso. The master is taking advantage of his control of the eved and abusing him. Ki lo yuchal akos b'bar Yisrael achiv, because he's not able to abuse anybody else, so he's taking it out on the eved, and therefore he is going to face nikama, vengeance. It's not just that he's being executed because he killed somebody, but it's viewed as vengeance for the abuse that he provided. So this is obviously a punishment for somebody who did something terrible to his eved, but it's also with the turret. It sets up the rules for how people are to conduct themselves. You can't just do whatever you want to the eved. And then one more rule, and this is the one that we're going to end up coming back to. Take a look at source number 4, also our parsha. If one should strike the eye of his eved, male or female, and destroy it, send him away free. The eved goes free in the event that the eved loses an eye. And in the event that it's a tooth, also, they go free in place of the lost tooth. So what we're seeing here is, in the event that you injure them with the tooth or the eye, they get to go free. Obviously, this is in part, again, punishment, but it's also, again, a deterrent. It helps prevent physical threats to the person of the eved, so that the eved kanani is there willingly. The Eved Kanani has to be treated with basic kavod, and the Eved Kanani has protections to avoid physical harm. This is, I guess, what you could say here is that it's a set of protections of the honor and the safety of the Eved. When you deal with a Jewish Eved, then there's another layer.
Why is it so specific to the teeth and the eye? Like, why can't it just be more general and say you cannot place a hand on the slave himself?
Right. So there is discussion actually about other things.
Other body parts. Like,
right. So there is discussion about other parts also. It's called in the Gemara Rashi Ivarim, the ends of other, or other parts as well. I realized as I started today that I really ought to have brought a piece on that also. I think I may send it out in the follow-up email. I just made a note for myself about it.
I mean, a tooth and an eye is not really equal.
No, they're not equal at all. They're not the same thing.
Exactly.
They're not the same thing. This is true. Well, unless people really like to eat, but yes.
It's so much worse to lose an eye than...
I mean, we're going to see...
Weren't there an eye for an eye? Like, there's times in the Torah where it's like...
The Torah does have the eye for an eye, which is usually understood to be payment. Not...
I know, but does that have anything to do here with it? Like, the fact that it's an eye?
No, because there you also have other injuries that are mentioned. But we're going to come back to this, and we'll see some explanations of the law that actually do tie into the eye and the tooth specifically. So we're not done with that. But take a look now at the Eved Ivri protections, which seem to give a whole an added layer of protection. So take a look at source number 5. This is from the Torah in Parshas Behar, where you get the rules in general for an Eved Ivri, a Jewish Eved. The Hebrew's at the bottom of one side, English is at the top of the next side. V'chiyamuch achicha imach v'nimkar lach. If your brother becomes indigent with you and is sold to you, lo sa'avod bo avodas aved, don't treat him as you would treat an eved. Don't treat him as you would treat an eved. And now we're going to find out, you know, what this means. Kisachir kisoshav ye imach, achnas hayovel yavod imach. He is like somebody you hire to do a job. He's like somebody who comes to live among you. He works for you until the yovel year. Assuming that, let's finish the psukim, and then I'm going to go back and explain all of this. Then he leaves you along with his kids. He goes back to his family. He goes back to his ancestral portion. Meaning, while he is your eved, he can be married so to speak, a shifra, a non-Jewish shifra, and then there are kids. But when he leaves, his kids go with him. That's what, is that what this is talking about? I'm not 100% sure that's what, no, scrap that. I'm not sure that's what this is talking about. I'm thinking I'm confusing two things. But he goes back to his family. Hashem says, they are my avadim. They shall not be sold as regular avadim, they're my avadim. Lo sir devo befarech. Do not make him work with perech. We'll talk about what that is. V'yareisam elokecha, and you shall revere Hashem your God. So what does this actually look like? So number one, he's not sold on the slave block. When it says, lo yimachum im keres aved, they should not be sold as an eved, you don't put him out there on the market in the way that they used to sell slaves with an auction up on display and so on. That's not allowed for an Eved Ivri.
How does one become an Eved Ivri?
So there are two basic ways to become an Eved Ivri. Either if somebody steals and is not able to pay off whatever the theft was, and then he would be sold by the Beit Din. The court would actually sell him. Or alternatively, somebody who is absolutely broke, has no food, has no money for clothing, nothing, and so they were allowed to sell themselves as an Eved. Those are the two cases in which one would be allowed to be sold. And the basic rules, and I was going to start to say this with the Yovel, but I'll say it here. The basic rule is, he can be sold for up to 6 years. There's some debate about selling for like some smaller part, but most of the Rishonim, I think, believe that you can be sold for 2 years or 3 years or whatever it is, corresponding with what the theft was or the money that's needed. But max 6 years. If Yovel comes along, then automatically he goes free. In the event that after 6 years, this is in our parsha, he decides, you know what, I still want to be an Eved, then he has his ear pierced and he stays until Yovel. That's your basic set of rules. So take a look at source number 6. What is this avodas perech that we will not give him? So the Rambam writes, Kol Eved Ivri Osur Lavod Bo Befarech. You are not allowed to make an Eved Ivri work with Perech. Ve'ezu Avodas Perech. What does that mean? Zu Avoda She'ein La Kitzba. Work without limit. You're never like done. You never like, get fulfillment like, okay, closure. Here, I did the job. Va'avoda She'ein Otsarich La Elatia Machshavaso La'avido Bilvad Shali Batel. Or work that's not needed other than just that he'll be working, so he shouldn't be idle. It's bad for him to be idle. If he's idle, he's going to want to rest more. He's going to want vacation. So let me just give him busy work. You're not allowed to give him that kind of labor. You're also not allowed to give him Eved work, a Avodas Aved, we said in the Pasuk. So the Rambam explains what that is. Kol Eved Ivri, Asur Li Yisrael Shekanahu Laha Avido B'Dvarim Bozim. You're not allowed to make an Eved Ivri work with work that will be considered degrading. Shem Yuchadim Lasos Avadim, the type of thing that only Avadim do. Such as, he says, carrying the master's stuff, kalim, clothing, whatever, to the bathhouse, removing his shoes for him. You're not allowed to have him do that kind of work. That's generally considered to be less honorable work. And then, perhaps the most famous, is in source number 7, the Gemara in Kiddushin. It talks about the Eved, the Torah talks about the Eved who wants to remain with you. Why does he want to remain? The Pasuk says, Ki tov lo yimach, because he's actually doing pretty well. He's happy. It's good for him with you. Says the Gemara here, quoting the Brei. So what does that mean? It's good for him with you? The emphasis is on the word with you. Imach b'machal, with you in food. Imach b'mishta, with you in drink. Shalotehe ato ochel pas nikia v'hu ochel pas kibar. That you shouldn't have him eating inferior bread, coarse bread, while you're eating refined bread, right? This is back in the day when people ate, you know, refined stuff. And, you know, now it's like the opposite. But the ata shose yayin yashan v'hu shose yayin chadash. You're drinking nice aged wine and he drinks the new stuff. You're sleeping on cushions. He sleeps on straw. None of those are acceptable. He has to have at least as good as you do. That's the rule. Mikan Amru, such that they said, Kalakona Eved Ivri Kikona Adoma Asmo. You acquire a Jewish Eved, you're acquiring a master for yourself, because he's going to get at least as good, if not better than, you do.
Is there different forms of compensation depending on the type of Eved that you are?
Meaning
if you are an Eved because you stole and you have to pay back, do you work amount of time based on the compensation of whatever it is that you stole, or the owner pays you back in some sort of a compensation? Like, is there a...
Right, so the answer seems to be that the Beis Din that's doing the selling of the person who stole is going to evaluate how much the debt is, and then they're going to effectively arrange the purchase with someone and say, well, this Eved is worth X. And they're going to say, therefore, you're getting him for whatever period of time it is. That's the way it works. And then the person who's acquiring the Eved is paying off the theft. Whereas if somebody sells himself, so he's getting his money up front, so to speak. In other words, he's getting whatever payment it is for him to be an Eved. That's the way that the Gemara takes it and the Rambam takes it. So, this is an added layer, meaning with the non-Jew, we had protection of their physical person and protection of their freedom in the sense that this is something they choose to do, and Kavod Abriah's basic dignity. This, on the other hand, gives a higher level of honor to them and a higher level of comfort to them. Right, in terms of the food they eat, in terms of where they sleep, in terms of the, you know, not giving them the types of jobs that would be viewed as slave jobs, those kinds of things. So all of this seems to create a two-tiered system, right? And I think it seems fairly clear that that's true. And yet, here's the problem. Remember that we made this statement that when it comes to the knocked out tooth and eye, the Eved Kanani goes free. So who doesn't go free?
Eved Ivri.
Yeah. Take a look at source number 9. It's the Gemara in Kiddushin. Tana Rabbanan, Braisa says, Pasuk is from our Parsha, Im Begapo Yavo Begapo Yetze. This is talking about the Eved Ivri, the Jewish Eved. If he enters with his body, he leaves with his body. Begufo Nichnas, Begufo Yatsa. His body he enters, with his body he leaves. So the Gemara asks, well, what does that mean? Omar Rava, Rava explains, Lomar She'eno Yotzei Barashay Evarim Ke'eved. He doesn't leave for the loss of a body part the way that an Eved, meaning an Eved Kanani, would. So Tosfos asks the question that you have to ask, which is, what happened? Why is there a protection here for the Eved Kanani that doesn't apply to the Eved Ivri? Source number 10, Tosfos, reading you my translation, because I looked and noticed the time. I would have thought he should be no worse than an Eved Kanani, who does not even leave after 6 years. Right? The Eved Kanani is there indefinitely. And yet, he, the Abaknani leaves due to loss of the ends of his Evarim. I don't understand what happened. So everyone is clear on the question? Okay. So I want to show you our three traditional approaches, some clearly rational and some that are clearly not, and then offer you a fourth answer, which of course is the one I like. So the first one, the Kliyakar's approach, is metaphysical. This is not meant to be taken as pshat. This isn't about the law. But it's a really interesting idea, and it goes back to the question of why tooth and eye specifically. He thinks it is davka, tooth and eye. I'm going to explain it outside, and then we'll see a little bit of an excerpt from him where he says it. He says, Jews are not freed by the loss of their appetites. That's what he says. When you lose your appetite as a Jew, you don't go free. What in the world does he mean by that? He says, life is an experience of slavery. Everyone, and it's very optimistic, like upbeat, nice thing, thought for a Thursday morning. He says, everybody is a slave to something. Human beings are slaves to their appetites, and it's expressed by the eye, which sees things, and therefore people want them, and the tooth, talking about eating. Jews, he says, are supposed to go beyond that kind of slavery to be slaves instead to Torah. Instead of to your appetite, it's to the will of God. So he says, an Eved Kenani doesn't have Torah. So liberation comes when his appetites are no longer in control of who he is. Meaning, normally, a person ages, and at a certain point they don't see as well, and at a certain point they don't taste food as well, or they lose teeth and they have trouble eating. And at that point, they are liberated from the appetites that they had. Yeah, isn't it? Well, it's not horrible, just depressing. He says that in the course of normal life, people lose their appetites, and so what he says is, that's their freedom. If the human master accelerates that liberation by knocking out the tooth, by knocking out the eye, then they go free already now. Whereas, for a Jewish Eved, he says, liberation from desire, from appetites, doesn't liberate you from your enslavement to Torah. Therefore, he doesn't go free. It took me a long time to understand what he was saying and figure out how to present this. That's exactly what he's saying. Take a look at number 11. We'll just go with my English translation in the interest of time, but you can see the Hebrew there as well. As long as both the teeth and the eyes are in their strength, right? Meaning in their powers, right? He jumps, quote, from food to food. Oh, God, I'll take this, I'll take that, I'll take that. Therefore, the Torah frees an Eved Kenani when his tooth or eye are knocked out, measure for measure. For this is the freedom he also chooses from his life's work. For he also doesn't stop pursuing emptiness other than with the loss of his tooth and eye. He's going to be a slave to his appetites as long as he has them. Once his appetites are gone, he's no longer a slave to them. So too here, he lost his tooth and eye, so no longer should he be a slave. As opposed to a Jew who's supposed to be a slave to God and to the Torah of God. So losing the tooth and eye don't stop that. As I said, this is not pshat. It's really the Kliyakar giving a nice bright Torah about the tooth and the eye and losing one's tooth and eye and avdus. But the Or HaChaim, Rav Chaim ben Attar, presented a different answer, which is much more practical. He says, for the Eved Ivri, realistically, getting paid is better than being released. Meaning, in the event that you're not releasing him, right? Or to put it differently, as the Or HaChaim envisions it, you have two paths. Path number one is treated the same way as when you assault anybody. If you assault somebody, you have to pay nezek, tsar, ripui, sheves, and boshes. You have to pay for nezek, harm, depreciation literally. You have to pay for pain that you caused. You have to pay medical bills. You have to pay time lost from work. And you have to pay any embarrassment that was associated with the injury. Those are the normal penalties, some of which won't apply necessarily in this case, but that's overall the way it works. As the Or HaChaim envisions it, if you liberate him, then you don't pay him any of these things. Like, I gave you your freedom, you're done. That's it. So he says, yeah.
You're
not going to be a good
slave because you're damaged.
Well, that's definitely true in terms of getting a future job.
And then lets him go. And he has
right. So he says, That's his idea. He says getting money is better than early release, because the master's going to have to pay for all of the harm that he caused, number one. And number two, he's going free anyway at the end of 6 years. And in fact, this could happen at the end of his 6 years. Right? Imagine that this happened the week before, and all you did is say, okay, fine, you go away a week early. He's better off getting paid. That's the way that the Or Haim positions it in terms of the Eved Ivri. I would challenge this and say, well, why not say free him and pay him? Right. Like, why is it an either or? That's not clear to me. But he says, when you're dealing with the Eved Kanani, on the other hand, freedom is better. Because the Eved Kanani has no set date of when he's going to go free. In fact, the Torah actually says, we're going to come back to this La'olam Ba'em Ta'avodu, keep him as an Eved. You're not letting him go. So what good would payment do for him? Better that he should be free. So he is helped by being free. For an Eved Kanani, we force the master to be a vatran, to give, and just say, let him go. But for the Eved Ivri, we're not going to do so. So you might look at this and say, well, you're exchanging money for freedom, and that seems fairly crass, right? You're saying, well, I'll take the money and stay as an Eved. But that's exactly why this person became an Eved in the first place. Right? That's why they did it. They couldn't support themselves, and they said, I need somebody else to take care of me, and I'm forfeiting my freedom for economic security. That's really what this is fundamentally about. So that's the Or Haim's position. Take a look at number 12. I brought you an excerpt. He says, it appears that the reason is that a Jewish Eved has the right not to leave for his tooth and eye, for his master must pay him for his eye and tooth and the other payments, which will cost more. It's going to cost him more, especially when this happens after some of his 6 year service, sometimes at the end. Therefore, God established the Jewish Eved to take payment for his eye. That's the idea that the Or Haim puts out there. So we have two explanations so far. One is metaphysical, not meant to be literal. The other one is very practical. Money may be better than freedom for the Eved Ivri. Third approach is a medrash in the Psikta Zutrata, which goes, again, back towards the drash approach and harder to accept as literal, but that's okay. He also goes back to what we said in the beginning about Eved Kanani being a Kananite specifically. And the medrash says the following. Go back to the story of Noach. After the Mabul, Noach plants the vineyard and gets drunk, and we know what happens. Ham looks in on Noach, tells his brothers. Canaan, the youngest son of Ham, gets cursed. Right? Why Canaan? Medrash says he was one who told his father, he was involved somehow in all of this. Not the point right now. But Canaan is cursed as a result of this looking in on Noach and telling his brothers. Looking in is the eye telling his brothers the tooth. So take a look at the Medrash in source number 13. Why does an Eved Kanani leave for his tooth and eye? Because Ham, father of Canaan, saw his father's exposure with his eye, and he told his brothers shamelessly, showing them his teeth. His freedom shall come only with his shame when the eye or tooth are knocked out. It's a remarkable idea. It's clearly drash. I mean, this is not meant as pshat, and he doesn't address at all the question of the Eved Ivri, right? That's not even his focus. Also, as we noted, Eved Kanani applies to non-Jews in general. It isn't only about Kananim. So that doesn't work here either. We also don't really view the chait of Ham and Canaan as the chait of every Kanani. But what he does accomplish here, which leads me to the approach that I actually favor here, is to an idea that I think is important to understand, which is that the avdus of a Kanani, the slavery of a Kanani, is fundamentally different from the slavery of a Jew in the Torah's conception of it. It serves a different purpose. Even if both are called Eved, yeah, there's one term the Rambam likes to use called Shem Mishutaf, another one is a Shem Mushal. Shem meaning a word, not name per se, but a noun in this case, which is either Mishutaf, it's used in partnership for two different things, or mush'al, it starts out being used for one thing and then it's borrowed to apply it to something else. The word eved is used in both cases, but they're actually two different situations. From the Torah's perspective, I believe, an eved kanani Why is there such an institution as Eved Kanani at all? It's a means of helping a Jew to have his work done so that he is free to be an Eved to Hashem. That's the idea. It's not about subjugating the Kanani. It's not about let's keep them down and make them inferior in our society and enslave them. Rather, it's about making the Jew available to be a slave to Hashem. The Sefer HaChinuch says this. Sefer HaChinuch on slavery is a little bit difficult for a variety of reasons. Some of the things he says are things I'm very uncomfortable with. But this part of what he says I like very much. Take a look at number 14. Just a little excerpt here. He says, if Jews don't have avadim from the nations, someone's going to have to do the work. They will need to have their brethren as avadim, and they will not be able to serve God. Therefore, we are commanded to hold them for our use. It's about the idea that you're supposed to be an Eved to Hashem. Therefore, you need somebody to take care of the work. For that, you hire the Eved Kanani. But the focus in this case is about helping the Jew to have his work done. Who is the beneficiary here? In the Eved Kanani situation, who is the beneficiary? Sorry?
The Jew.
Right? The Adon, the master, right? That's the one who is benefiting from this circumstance. Contrast that with Eved Ivri. Who's the beneficiary in the Eved Ivri situation?
The
Eved. This is Staka. It's a form of chesed. You are keeping him and his family alive and supported for a defined period of time. Right? That's what it is. The Torah demands of the relatives of the Eved that they actually marshal funds to redeem him. In the event that he's sold to someone who isn't Jewish. Take a look at number 15 from Parshas Behar. I brought you the JPS translation. I got tired of translating things. But if a resident alien among you has prospered, resident alien is ger toshav. Mm. It means someone who isn't Jewish, who's living among you, is observing the seven mitzvos. So if he has prospered, and your kinsman, being in straits, comes under his authority and gives himself over to the resident alien among you. There's a Jew who sells himself as an Eved to the non-Jew because he can't afford to support himself, or to an offshoot of the Ger Toshav's family. He shall have the right of redemption even after he has given himself over. He can buy himself out. Now you'll say, well, how's he going to buy himself out? One of his kinsmen shall redeem him. His uncle's son shall redeem him. Anyone of his family who is of his own flesh shall redeem him. Or if he prospers, so fine, he'll redeem himself. And how do you do it? You calculate how many years he was supposed to be an Eved, and how many years he's already worked, and you just prorate the purchase price, as is explained here. But you're supposed to try to get him out of it if he's sold to a non-Jew.
Why on earth would a non-Jew want a Jew as a slave? There's all these parameters he has to do.
He's not Jewish. Why? Who says he's going
to
follow any of this? Correct. He's going to do what he wants to do.
Yeah. So why would the Jew want to sell himself to that? He doesn't. He's looking for
survival. And
there's no one Jewish that's
willing. There's no one Jewish maybe who is able to or willing to, because they look at all these rules and say,
exactly.
Why do I need this?
The downside that there's so many rules almost because they make them
not
as wanting to have them.
Precisely. Which is why the Torah says, if he's sold to a non-Jew, you have to try to buy him out of it. You should have taken care of him the other way. What you'll never see here is condemnation of the Jewish master. It never says if a Jew is sold to another Jew, as in Eved, you should buy him out. It doesn't say that.
Right.
Because this is fundamentally a means of support for him. So the beneficiary, in this case, is actually the Eved. That's the difference. So when you're dealing with an Eved Kanani, this is a non-Jew who was acquired either because he sold himself, or he was sold by a non-Jew who had been his master beforehand, like we saw in the beginning. Or he was captured in battle, right? That's another way in which this could happen. He is performing the tasks that the master is unwilling or unable to perform. You can't coerce him into being an Eved, but the beneficiary is very clearly the master. He's having his work done. So because the idea here is liberate the Jews so that the Jewish master will be able to serve Hashem, you have a mitzvah of la'olam b'hem ta'avodu. Don't free the Eved. Because if you free the Eved, now you're back to doing those tasks and not serving Hashem. But because the goal is that you're supposed to serve Hashem, the master is not allowed to be cruel. You're going to serve Hashem by being cruel to the Eved? That's not an option. And so we're told if you're cruel to the Eved, you knocked out his tooth, you knocked out his eye. That's not happening. You have to free him. And this not only is an after the fact penalty, but as we said before, it's a deterrent. The protection is logical for the non-Jewish Eved. The master is the beneficiary; he has to be held accountable. That's one way. However, with the Eved Ivri, the master is the benefactor. He rescued this person from starvation when his community failed him, when his family failed him. You know, this is something that I think is very important to recognize. Just the Rambam talks about in the first chapter of his Hilchos Avadim, his laws of slaves, that Torah does not allow someone to be sold as a slave unless he has no money for clothing, no money for food. Like, he has to be destitute. So he's been failed by everybody. He should have gotten stuck. That's what should have happened. But it didn't. So the master says, I'm going to give you food and board. I'm not going to give you demeaning work. I'm not going to give you painful work. When he leaves, he gets, we didn't talk about this, ha-naka, right? He gets gifts that are supposed to set him up for the future. Ha-nik ta-nik lo, the Torah says. He gets a fresh economic start after the 6 years. So the Torah doesn't want to penalize a master who has done this. The Torah doesn't want to make it harder. It's already hard enough to do that. Even if he wounds the slave, we're going to assume that this was the result of a mistake. This wasn't the sign of some kind of a broader problem. So he'll pay damages, but that's all he's going to have to do. He's not freeing him. You follow? That to me is the logic. That's why this works. It's two different systems entirely, going in different directions in terms of who the beneficiary is. Now, I wanted to conclude this with one point before we do the review questions. I will do the review questions first and then come back to my concluding point on this. Number one, what are some laws that protect the non-Jewish Eved? Right? We said that it's voluntary. Right? That he can't be coerced. The death penalty for killing him. Freedom if he is wounded in these ways. His basic kavod abrios, he has basic dignity. Additional protections for the Jewish Eved are respectful sale. He can't be sold on the market. He can't be given this avodas perach, either busy work or endless work. He can't be given, demeaning work, right? He gets the best resources in the house. He goes free with gifts after the 6 years are over. And in terms of why the Eved Ivri is not freed with loss of a tooth or eye, while the Eved Kanani is, either because the Ivri doesn't work due to appetites, right? He's supposed to be serving Hashem. That was the Kli Yakar's very interesting idea. Or the Or Chaim's very practical point that the money is better for him than being released early. Or the Medrash's idea that Cham sin doesn't relate to us, this Beira of Cham, with the seeing Noach and reporting it, doesn't apply to us, it only applies to the Kanani. Or, because Eved Ivri is about helping the Eved, as opposed to Eved Kanani, which is about helping the master. So, just the closing thought that I have when I think about this is that the idea of purchasing the freedom of a human being, right? The idea that somebody says, "I'm in such bad straits that I'm willing to forfeit my ability." Well, let me state it the other way. The Torah says that when it comes to being an employee, a poel, you are able to leave midday. Someone hires you and says, I want you to work in my field, I'm going to pay you X amount, and you decide partway through, you know what, I'm not liking this. I don't enjoy it, I don't like the people I'm working with, my back hurts, whatever it is, I'm leaving. You can do that. 100% able. You just forfeit the rest of the day's pay because you're not doing the work, but you get paid for the work you did, and you walk away. You're not an Eved. What makes an Eved different is that the Eved has decided it's worth it to me to forfeit the ability to leave partway. I'm an Eved for the full 6 years, or whatever period of time it is that the Eved is being sold for. So today, the idea of purchasing a human being's freedom is anathema, right? The idea, I hope, the idea that you can acquire somebody and say, no, you're not allowed to leave. It doesn't matter if you're miserable. It doesn't matter if your circumstances have changed. You're not able to walk away. is something we don't like. But if Western society has moved past that harsh aspect of slavery, you stop to ask yourself a question, which is, what have we done to replace the benevolent aspect? Right? Where is the safety net for the people who are in need? Because that's what this fundamentally is about.
I was just thinking, it's not so bad for those people. They had an out if no one took care of them.
I mean, it's terrible to not have one's freedom. But, like, what are we offering? I happened to be, I was in Boston on Sunday for something. And, like, I saw, on Sunday morning, I saw homeless people sleeping outside of, the bus shelters and the like. And it's not just Boston, it happened to be where I was. But, like, what are we doing? Like, so where's your solution for the problem? I think that's a question that, that we do have to face up to. Expecting that everybody's just going to manage things for themselves is unrealistic.
So. It was probably the norm then for a lot of people to be as it is, and then the highs and the lows of the community and like that then, and it was probably very normal.
So we don't have numbers, at all on the quantity of avadim to really be able to figure it out. But it wouldn't surprise me that we have enough stories in in Chumash and in Tanakh and in Gemara about avadim. Correct.
I mean, like, they started somewhere and they went all the way down. So there's in between, there's levels. So and all those levels, nobody took care of them.
Correct.
Talk about what kind of...
Right. No, there were other means that were supposed to be used before we got to this point.
Right.
Correct.
Of what kind of work they were allowed to do? So I'm trying... It couldn't be the meaning, couldn't be, but I'm trying to...
So they could work...
Farm work, but what, like... Person serves Hashem, but also has work, right? Even today. So, what exactly?
So the Gemara talks about in commenting on the Chumash that you could have an Eved who was working in the field, and you could have an Eved who was cutting gems.
Okay.
Anything.
Yeah. Like, it doesn't matter. It's almost like an employee in a way.
It is. It's an employee, except that the employee doesn't have the ability to go home. And doesn't have the ability to. Let's not overly.
But there are
people
to do that.
They have nowhere to go for the government. Took care of people. Now that they have welfare, they didn't have that. So it was a person taking someone to their home. And this is how they figured it out.
Except that, again, they don't have the freedom to leave. Like, that's not a minor thing.
Yeah, they weren't free to go.
But some of them probably were happy, otherwise they would die. They were homeless.
Correct. No, and that's why people did it.
But it wasn't like slavery. Like,
it's not a best case scenario.
It's still bad.
And they got paid on top of it, right? It's not that the work was...
So you got paid in the beginning. The Adon provides them with payment. That's either, if he was a thief, it's paying off the theft. And if he was not a thief, he just sold himself, then it's a lump sum, whatever that amount is.
Right, so it wasn't the room and board was the payment for...
Correct. There's actually some discussion about how that works. It's a larger topic, but in terms of the distinction between an employee and an Eved, that's one of the points of distinction that are drawn, is that the Eved is paid up front, whereas the employee is paid along the way, and that's one of the reasons why an employee is able to leave in the middle. Whereas with the Eved, you got paid for your work already up front, how can you now walk away?
But then how are they supposed to go after that? Like, it's kind of a flawed system, because they take them in, and then afterwards... They don't give them any kind of skills in order to, what was the job then, farmland? What did people do?
Farming was a common...
Whatever, it's not like they took them in for 6 years and gave them some kind of skills or anything in order to survive after they leave that person's house.
How do you know?
I'm saying, what did they do?
What we do know is they had this Ha'anaka, where you're supposed to give them gifts at the end. So that's meant to be, it's understood as a start for where they're going. But whether there was any training, it sounds like if it existed, it was something that the other may have chosen.
It should have been training.